morning, or good afternoon, actually, as the case is, and welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday Special. It's our 41st Sunday Special, which shows how long COVID has been going on, because we're doing this in lockdown in this fashion. And this morning we have a brilliant packed panel again, with the exception of my co-host from the Echo Chamber, Martin McMahon.
I knew that was coming. I absolutely knew that was coming.
We are joined by our friend in Madrid, Professor Joe Haslam. Joe, good to see you again.
Yes, great to be here, Tony. Great to be here.
We have our good friend of the podcast, architect Orla Hegarty. Orla, how are things?
Good morning. Good to see everybody.
Good to see you too. And we are going to kick things off with a first-time guest to the show, one of the founders of the Muslim Sisters of ERA, Lorraine O'Connor. Lorraine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, I really appreciate this. We had a short chat yesterday in relation to a post you put up on social media that went viral. I'm just going to give you the floor and ask you to explain to our listeners what you're seeing on the ground in terms of the situation, in terms of poverty and just the COVID poor, I think is how you referred to it yesterday to me.
Okay, so I'm just going to rewind back pre-COVID, okay? And for the past, we're going into our sixth year, we run a super loan outside the GPO. And you know, pre-COVID, I suppose we would have been horrified in the amount of homelessness there is in Ireland, and how much people need basic food, basic hygiene packs, a packet of underwear, a pair of socks. And COVID came along. And I remember distinctly when COVID came along, because we reached our 10th anniversary of Muslim Sisters of ERA. And we had an amazing night in the Hilton Hotel where we had nearly 200 plus guests at it. And we were celebrating 10 years of achievements that Muslim Sisters of ERA have achieved over the 10 years. And we had it on the 16th of March. And it had just been announced that Paddy's Day had been cancelled. And we were all kind of in there going, ah, oh, give me a hug. This is ridiculous. It's in China or whatever. You know what I mean? We were like just oblivious to the wave of what was going to come and what was coming. And the following Friday, the lockdown was announced, and there was fear. The fear that went into everybody's house. I think there wasn't a person in Ireland who had this fear. This is the plague. It's going to kill us. We're afraid to touch the unseen kind of bacteria. You can't even see it. What are we living in? And I remember thinking to myself, what are we going to do with the homeless? How are we going to do this? You know, we are open there. We're visibly open to 250 people a week. And I was like, you know, we can't stop this. We have to keep going. And we went down that Friday night, and the following week then, you know, there was no social distancing. It was about washing your hands, where we were like, stay over there. We'll come over with food to you. It was all, you know, up in air. We didn't know what we were doing at that stage. So I think the following week then we decided that we'd start giving the food from the back of the cars at the side of Princess Street to break down that initial clutter of people coming together. And we did that, and it went really well. But it was also very sad that there was people still in the streets. The streets, if you go back to March of last year, early April, the streets, everybody was hiding. We were all hiding. The streets were completely empty. Yet there was still 250 plus people queuing at the back of Princess Street at our cars for food. And unfortunately, the following week, the first strike, one of our volunteers got it, and she was very ill. Then the following week we're there, the second strike, another one of our volunteers caught it, and she became very ill. And then her whole household caught it. And we were like, okay, I've got to shut down. So we shut down, had to, because the volunteers were starting to go. And at this stage, we didn't really know what was happening. We closed down for 2 months, from April to the 1st of June. And at the 1st of June, the numbers dropped dramatically. If you remember last June, we were back in about 29 cases a day or 30 cases a day. And at that stage, then we were more educated on what COVID was about. Now, when I said we shut down for the 2 months, we did outreach work. four nights a week. So we were going out in our cars, going down the canals, going the back of up, you know, the back of Moore Street, the back of Parnell Street. You know the spots when you're out there 6 years where they are, they still were. And we were still giving them food, and we did these emergency pack called COVID packs, which was a hygiene bag, hand sanitizer, masks, gloves, a survival mechanism for them. And June we opened back up, and we went from 250 meals per week. And we know this from our graft and our database. The first week we were there with 250 meals. We were there half an hour and we were cleared out. And I was like, what? We're usually here 2 hours. No food for people that were coming to the table. And you start seeing this, as I call it now, COVID poverty starting to appear. And you start to hear stories where, sorry, usually we would have down there three types of homeless, which would be people in a hotel accommodation, people in hostels, and rough sleepers on the streets. But now there were people coming down who had houses and were saying, I can't keep food on the table. The schools are closed. My teenage children and my children, and one woman I'll always remember, and it sounds funny, but it really wasn't. She was like, my children are like Pac-Man.
Just going to interrupt the podcast here. Look, we're looking for money again. We have to do this. This is how we survive. And I just want to say, we have great days too, Tony. We do have great days. Tony had a great, or sorry, Rory had a great day about housing. You had a great day on finance. I'm having a good time on Bogus Self-Employment. So we do a lot of other work as well. It's important that we keep this podcast going. It's our direct line to be able to highlight subjects we think are important to the public.
I think that is it in a nutshell. It's like when you see the volume of people engaged, Rory's piece, Rory had one over on me. I said to him, Rory, you've been writing that since 2013. And he said, I know. And I was writing 2013 and I'm right today. So yeah,
20 years to be an overnight success, Tony.
Yeah, this is it though. And this is the reality. But without the Tortoise Shack, does that happen, Martin? Without that agency, without that platform, without that bit of clout that we have, you know, like, I mean, there are radio stations that would give their hands for the sort of listenership we have. And yet it's not viable.
And we can't stick all those ads in like a radio does too, Tony. We have to be careful.
Would you advertise with us if you thought that we were going to be, anti-investment and anti-capital, anti-vulture fund? That's where, like, you think all these other, there's radio stations that go from discussion on banks and then into an advert for a B with AIB, you know, sponsored by. So, you know, like, I don't care what you say. The quiet hand of editorial control comes in many forms, and we don't want ads.
There's no editorial control here, Tony. There's no quiet hand.
No, absolutely not. And we shouldn't have it. But we do need you, as our listener, to go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There's a range of options there. It's from the price of a cup of coffee up to a couple of quid. And you know what? There's loads of benefits as well. We will be live on Sunday. You get to come along, have a bit of crack. And there's other things going on. But just help us out. Thanks very much. And we will go back to the podcast now and enjoy it.
Hold on before you do that, Tony. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack.
Thanks, Martin.
But now there were people coming down who had houses and were saying, I can't keep food on the table. The schools are closed. My teenage children and my children, and one woman I'll always remember, and it sounds funny, but it really wasn't. She was like, my children are like Pac-Man. They're just eating, eating, eating. And we were all eating and eating when we were on lockdown. We were all getting fatter. But remember, the social welfare was always was cut as well. Initially, people were getting the social welfare once a week. They cut that to fortnightly. So the middle class people, or you say the lower class people, couldn't survive, you know, keep food on the table, keep basic needs. And then they were starting to come down to the GPO and they were starting to look for hampers. They were ringing us. At that stage, then we were giving out about 100 hampers a week, ringing us, I need food, I need help, I need, you know, on top of the people in hotel accommodation, rough sleepers and people in hostels. So we never closed down. Right in the peak of it in January, we closed down for 2 weeks only. And the reason why we closed down, it went to us all, including my home. Six of us in this house contracted it. Now, thank God, I always believe when you do good, good comes back. It didn't get me. But, you know, six of my family had it, and including my 12-week-old granddaughter contracted it as well. And we had to shut down. all our volunteers were going like Skittles. And at the same time, I was arguing with Stephen Donnelly's secretary, saying, you know, they weren't recognizing us, even though we're a registered HSC Superrun, a registered charity, as frontline workers. They said, you've got to give us the vaccine. We're now up in 500 to 560 people a week we're serving. 2 weeks later, we were back on the streets. And the graft, if you could see my graft, and Rachel, I didn't have it here to share it with you, it's in the office, is with the way it's gone up in what we're buying per monthly now in Musgrave. So you know by the takeaway packs you buy, you know by your food count, you know by your cups, you know by your spoons, you know by your serviettes and so forth and so on. Last week, 580 meals we had. And I, you know, I'm down there 6 years and I've seen it all. I've literally seen it all. But last Friday night, I stepped back and I actually put my hands up and said, we're losing control. We're literally losing control. It was like, if you can just kind of vision in your head, we've 5-6 foot tables. And all of them tables are laid with everything you could think of, fruit, yogurts, bread, milk, sandwiches, lots of different kinds of meals, fruit, everything you could think of, hygiene packs, the whole lot. So we've 5-6 foot tables. So multiply, that's 30 foot in length. And we have a 7 security. And at the top of the table, we have one man and he stands and lets 3 per person go along the table, and then another 3 and another 3 to keep that distance as well, because we are still living in a pandemic. And he, no one's allowed at the table. I bring in 600 masks a week. He holds his masks. He gives each person a mask and he sprays their hands and they go along the table. We couldn't do it. They were swaying. The people were swaying that way. For the first time in 6 years, my volunteers looked at me and got frightened and said, oh my God, the tables are going to collapse. They're coming in on us. And I'm shouting at them. And, you know, you say, I'm not open. Move. Get the line down. We've never had this. You always have your line going right around. But last Friday, I was like, I think desperation has hit people. And it's like, you know, just seeing the sheer, like, people agitate. You skip the queue. I'm before you. Who are you? Get back there. And I'm like, there's enough for everybody. Obviously, there wasn't because we ran out of meals. But, like, just get back in the queue. I hear you. There was a young girl there, you know, she had so hard. She had a prostate leg, half a leg, basically, a false leg on.
Prosthetic leg, yeah.
prosthetic leg. Talk about being frustrated anyway. And, her chap, who was very under, you know, the influence of something. And he was saying to me, she can't queue up, she this, she that. And you're trying to gather people and you're trying to say, you sit there, don't worry, I'll seat you. And then you go and you get a meal for her and you sit her there and you look after and see if there's anything she needs. And then someone is shouting, why is she skipping the queue? It was just so agitated last week. I had to call the guards. I had to call the guards just to help us. Now, the guards are great. They didn't come in roughing them and saying, oh, who do you think? Yeah, they just stood by and helped us. And they were going in the queue. Everybody's going to get food. We're going to help you. Don't worry about it. Lovely young guard. And it was absolutely lovely. And it calmed down then after about 45 minutes. But that's where the tweet is. And that's the tweet that went viral.
Is this going to happen now every evening, Lorraine? Is that the fear?
Well, I'm there 6 years. No, we're still going to be there for another 6 years, please God. You know, hopefully there's never another need for another 6 years, to be honest with you. But look, I wouldn't say it's fear. I wasn't afraid down there because they would never hurt you. The homeless people and the people that come to our table have the height of respect for what we are given. The service users have the height of respect for not only my soup room, for every other soup room that's out there.
So desperation then? People are absolutely...
Well, yeah, people are in a bad way. And I mean, you only have to see that. And when I come back on Friday night, Darkness Into Light was on the Late Late Show. And I just caught the end of an interview. I'm not sure who it was. It was two girls. I think one of the mother had lost her sister to suicide. And Ryan Turbidy was saying, you know, we're going to have a lot of people with mental health issues coming out of the lockdown now, and suicide rate is going higher and so forth and so on. And rightly so. I completely 100% backed that up. But I wanted to shake the telly and go, do you not see what's happening? Do you not see the poverty that we have now? Do you not see the sheer desperation on people? Okay, the Late Late Show is raising money for a Pieta House, and so they should, totally with it on all of that. But you're bluntly ignoring the ripple effect of what's going on. It's not only mental health.
Can I just go to you there for a minute, Joe? Joe, in Madrid, are you having the same kind of problems?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting link. I was thinking how we were going to sort of link the two stories. And I guess the story in Madrid is very much down to the fact that in the working class districts, they voted for right-wing politicians, you know, which is, you know, an amazingly story that they, you know, there's always this thing in Madrid that 30% of the people will vote for, you know, lower taxes and brutalize criminals to, as the Simpsons might say. But it's the kind of the floating voters that are always the interesting. And the big result from this election, and you know, we can get into the reasons exactly why this was the case, that even in like the low-income districts, they voted for right-wing politicians. And they did that because they didn't believe that people who are offering a left platform, whether that was Podemos or the Socialist Party, had really anything to do for them, either in improving their lives or actually providing frontline services. So, you know, the situation in Madrid is always, I guess, you could say that, you know, charity has always been strong here. You know, Madrid always has a kind of a big city, and it brings in a lot of immigrants. And it's funny how immigrants are often very capable. They look after each other. There's a network. The other thing is the family unit is extremely strong here. So, you know, if I won the lottery, for instance, I wouldn't be able to keep the money. I'd have to like divide out the money among my family members. That family is very much seen. And that actually comes, oddly enough, from the Islamic tradition. Spain was an Islamic country. For, you know, 800 years, Christianity is really only a brief experiment that's passing through. And, you know, for the last 400.
We spoke briefly about this yesterday, Lorraine, as well, about the idea about the work that the Muslim Sisters of Era do, and why that comes from your faith is how you found it.
Well, the faith, you know, obviously one of the pillars of Islam is charity. But that goes back to 2.5. It's actually coming now in 2 or 3 days, the end of Ramadan. You have to give 2.5% of your wealth. That means your gold or your earnings to a charity. And that charity has to be, you know, people that are feeding the homeless or people that are in, you know, poor poverty countries. But there's also a charity, which is a voluntary charity. And that's part of the Islamic faith as well, Sadaqah. And that's what we're acting on. But I suppose my charity aspect would go back to my mother, and that she was a really, really strong Christian. And that would have been growing up in the north side of Dublin in the 1980s. I used to see my mother fasting for, at that time, John O'Shea, for Goethe and so forth and so on. And, you know, she did an awful lot for helping people who were homeless. So that's that, and combined with my faith, gives me the drive to keep going. And, you know, I do see there that one of them was saying about the super bonds. I can't really just got it there about we should focus on merchants key, so forth and so on.
Yeah, no, it was a question. It was Mick Finnegan was making the point, which is a fair point, that we have to be careful about cultural dependency. But you will also say, you I'll let you finish, but my point would be that in any system that could be gamed, there will be people who will game it, but it will be a tiny percentage of people who are at that.
Well, you know, down there on a Friday night, culture, race, creed, color, religion does not come into anything on a Friday night. You're down there to feed. You're down there for empathy, compassion. That's what you're there for, and you're down there to help people. Our soup run had been going on 6 years. About 3 months ago, I got a call from the environmental health officer. Now, taken to mind, there's about 18 soup runs, and none of them are registered, and maybe one or two. I got a call from the environmental health officer to say, I believe you're running a non-registered soup run down there. I said, well, I'm a registered charity, but we're not HSC registered. And they said, well, you have to be. And I said, right, okay. let's get a ball rolling. It cost us nearly 5,500 to rearrange the whole team, to get people together, to scrap all our tables or everything and redo it all, get all our volunteers trained with HSC certificates and registered our super own. Now, in fairness, again, it doesn't come in to culture. It doesn't come in to creed or religion. The women down there, the six main women down there, we'd have about 10 volunteers, six main women have all been, and we paid for it, €1,200 with the Order of Malta. They're all frontline, what you call them, first aid responders. Then they've all they're trained in domestic violence. They're trained in the rape crisis centre. We don't put this out, but these is the back of what is going on down there. And they're all Garda vetted. They're all Tulsa trained. And I have 5 Gashka leaders down there as well. Now, these women are immigrants. Well, some of them are, you know, not me. Might as well be coming from Gulag. And they're given back into the society. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and they're trained in what to do. There's court support. There's, you know, I link in with a lot of people. When we're down there on Friday night and someone comes to me and says, I've no home to go to tonight, I can guarantee you before we leave, we've sorted out some. We've linked in with Merchants Quay. We link in with Father McFerry. We've linked in with Inner City Help and the Homeless. We've linked in with a lot. So the structure of bringing the organisation, they're feeding off the homeless down there on a Friday night. I'd say take my hat off to the fella who made that phone call to the HSC, because now the facilitating is absolutely fantastic. Do you get where I'm coming from?
The service users now are
in a better space with us.
Lorraine, I know, and this is for the listeners' benefit. You didn't say this. Lorraine will have to leave us because she's actually going back off to work now. She's going to help with the a direct provision center shortly. So,
Tony, radio shows are much more important than actual doing things.
I suppose there's a flavor of some of the comments are saying, you know, that they really appreciate the work that you do, and that there's poverty, and then there's real poverty, and you're seeing on the front line. I would say if anybody wants to support you, how do they do that?
Just go on to www.mosc.ie. We do not, as a charity, I do not take any cash donations. That's out of the question. Everything has to go through the registered charity account. So there's 2 ways you can do that. You can do it on the donate button on Facebook and Muslim Sisters of Errors Facebook, or you can go on to the website www.msoe.ie. At the moment, we have delivered 360 gift wrap ties to the children in the direct provision, and that's where I'm running down now today. So on the morning of Eid, these children have a present to open to. But sorry I couldn't stay longer. I'd love to hear your other panels talking, but unfortunately, got to get to Wicklow.
Lorraine, thank you so much for that. Oh, and we do all echo. And it is such a pity that you have to do it. That's the worst of it, is that you have to do it.
Sure, it's a blessing as well. When you can help someone, it's a blessing. That's what I always say. You know, when you're able to reach that hand out and give to someone and just listen to them, and when you see that smile back, that's worth everything, every single thing. So I feel blessed that I'm able to do, and have an amazing team of women that were able to do what we're able to do. And just before I go, a huge thank you. I'm so proud to be Irish. A huge thank you to the Irish who are supporting us out there. Our government grants are very limited, but our PayPal and our donate button on Facebook just goes crazy, and it's majority 70%, because we keep an eye on everything, 70% is the Irish people. So I mean, I'm so proud of you, and I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, from Muslim Sisters of Error, to all of you out there who are listening.
Thanks, Lorraine.
I gotta go.
Thank you very much for coming on this morning, Lorraine.
Thank you. Take care, everybody, and lovely speaking.
Shukran.
Afwan. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum. Bye.
And I'm going to do this cut, and it's a crude cut, but straight into Orla Hegarty. Orla, all of us here in our free houses are looking to you and saying...
Well, could I first say thank you to Lorraine and the Muslim Sisters of Error for all
the... Of course you can,
It's incredible. It's really impressive to see just providing a hot meal and a listening ear. You know, it's kind of the essence of humanity, isn't it, really? Yes. They do amazing work.
So I'm going to ask you, Orla, we are looking at 2.5 years of a Fine Gael-led government on the way with a zombie Fianna Fáil party, the bluest green party we've ever seen, and disastrous housing policies. How do we avoid revolution?
I'm not going to get into party politics of it, but, you know, this crisis has been around now for the best part of 10 years. And, you know, on many levels, it's got worse. We were in a difficult situation back in 2012-13 with people needing housing. But now we're in a situation where not only are there people who need housing, there are people who are in housing who can't afford their housing and who are missing out on having money in their pockets or opportunities to change jobs or get involved in education and all sorts of other things because of the cost of their housing. So in some ways, I think the affordability crisis has just got worse. And we're in a difficult situation now because it's very difficult to reverse out of it. A lot of things have been baked in over the last 5 years. And a lot of opportunities, I think, have been missed to start to build capacity for alternatives.
Orla, sorry, can I come in really quickly? You've been advocating, you know, like you would say, apolitically, just, you know, for policies that can decrease the actual price of production of homes. And, you know, bring down actual producing affordable homes. So we've had you on this podcast several times. You've done brilliantly. We're on the late debate during the week and speaking about it. So we know the policies, but when you look at the new bill coming forward and then the uproar this week, you know, your man, Rory Hearn, is still off gallivanting on the back of his article in the Journal. I think he has two bottles of champagne and he's gone full smoke salmon socialist. But nonetheless, do you feel like, have been talking about this for the best part of 10 years, do you feel that we hit a tipping point this week?
Yeah, it felt. I suppose a lot of things just by complete coincidence happened this week. The story about the estate in Maynooth being sold off had a lot of media attention. The minister announced the affordable housing bill as well. And there was a lot of talk about the LDA and about investment funds and apartments. And so a lot of the stories were getting a lot of attention. And some things that have been around for a while maybe only caught the imagination. I think
Can I make one point? You've actually summed it up perfectly. Some things that have been around for a while caught the imagination. Leo Varadkar said the policies 10 years ago were right then, but mightn't be right now. That is a really convoluted way of saying we got this wrong for the last 10 years. But it's a, you know, if PR speak could write it better, that's a brilliant way of saying, Yeah, we did this. It was policy. And this is the sort of policy that you were told when you were advocating for alternatives, that you were the one that wasn't going to build any houses. You were a NIMBY.
Yeah. Well, if there was one thing I suppose I've been saying for quite a while is that there's a lot of moving parts in this. It's like looking into the mechanism of a watch, you know. And if you do something, you have to understand what that does somewhere else or what that might do. I think what we've had 10 years of, and some of this is maybe people new to commentating on this or new to understanding housing markets, an assumption that everything was always going up. So the graph just goes in one direction. If you can get supply going, it's going up forever. If you can get things moving and not de-risking the cycles in the market. You know, as we know, we get economic cycles and they hit very hard in construction and in capital investment. So everything kind of needs to be de-risked. So I suppose a match was thrown in on inflating prices to get people out of negative equity and to support the banks without any thought about what happens if it catches fire and it's 500,000 for an apartment in Dublin. What do we do then? You know, so yes, stimulating the market, but how do we stop it just getting out of control? Because you can't control the market.
And this estate was not the first time that they had bought en masse. It was just the first time that it had caught the imagination. I think because it had the prospect of being a nice middle class estate where first time buyers could buy, and it was those people being demonstrably cut out of the market that triggered the reaction this week. But am I right in saying that they've been buying wholesale for years now at this stage?
There's loads going on. I was looking at some numbers yesterday. $2.4 billion was spent by funds on apartments in 2019. $2.4 billion. Jesus. And $1.4 billion in 2020. Huge amounts of money. So that's obviously very inflationary. And then you've got the government trying to buy in that market as well as the first-time buyers. Everybody's trying to buy the same thing. And not, you know, very, very limited sector that's producing. So we've had prices double probably since Rebuilding Ireland started. The intention at the beginning when the government started to talk to these funds and new providers in that sector, the target actually set 5 years ago was to be producing apartments in Dublin between 200 and 260,000 for sale. And that's what the negotiation started at. And here we are with an affordable housing scheme for the same apartment at up to 500,000. So
and what it's what you absolutely specialize in is the costs of building, Orla. What should a reasonably priced house, should it be linked to salary?
Can we drop the whole, because this annoys everybody who thinks about this sensibly, houses versus apartments. It's just homes.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it seems to be okay if you're hollowing out Dublin city centre because it's only apartments that are going to these funds. It's there's an apartment block going up four cranes up the road from me and it just says one bidder preferred. They're just looking for go immediately into that market. This is where we are, but they are homes. I made the point previously during the week that the apartments, the homes that were bought en masse by a vulture fund from NAMA that were then taken by an asset manager in Tyrrellstown. That's the same process, but no one cared because the occupants were mostly African immigrant community. And, you know, there's been a lot of that awful stuff that's gone on. This has gone on much longer than 2 years. It's been going on since they were buying en masse from NAMA because that's you buy a loan book. But what is a loan book? You're buying those homes. That's what you're buying. Sorry, Orla. I just wanted to distinction.
I totally agree. But also, I suppose, from anybody in the construction or architecture sector, there isn't a distinction between houses and apartments. We talk about more dense developments. So we're used to very low density suburban housing. They need to be denser. I think we've got caught up in this false argument that the opposite of suburban housing is high rise, really dense apartments where you share a lift with hundreds of people and you've no lift, you've no proper daylight and you've no balcony and you're looking into a light well. Sustainable density is in between, but that isn't a sweet spot in the development sector at the moment. So what I mean by that is there's the sort of scale of terraced housing, low rise apartments, really pleasant places to live, whether you have a house at the end of it or an apartment in the middle of it or whatever, that makes proper streets and public spaces and, you know, nice areas to walk around. That isn't being catered to at all. And that's what we actually need. So this kind of false argument, I think, between over-dense apartments and under-dense housing has been a bit of a distraction. Like, if you look at the loads of parts of Dublin are really sustainable densities already without being high-rise. Mm. We need to sort of replicate that in a way that is pleasant and affordable.
I see, yeah.
It's done around the 250 probably thousand for people.
And it can, because we've seen it done it just has to be done at scale. Joe, if you wouldn't mind coming to you in terms of the rental market, Dublin to Madrid, have you given it, like when you look in Madrid now, what is the situation with rents? Are they spiraling every year or is there some sort of stability? Because we've built in a 4% minimum return. You know, like that's why these funds are here. We've said to them, upward only rent review of 4%. It's not a rent pressure zone. It's a guaranteed return. And you'd know that as a professor who teaches entrepreneurship.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, there's a lot of things I could say. First of all, I live in the building I'm speaking to you from is like six stories, you know, all families with the doorman. You know, we go in the evenings, we go on the street where there's cafes and restaurants, like it's all that kind of stuff that you know, you would associate. And I couldn't really think of living anywhere else. My wife would never want to live, you know, in a standalone house. She, you know, that's, you know, just not in any way her dream. The situation, of course, in Madrid goes back to the pre-democratic era, where there was this kind of feeling that if everyone had a house, there wouldn't be revolution, you know, to go back to kind of to Martin's point. So, you know, Spain is known as the city of the elevators, you know, that we, I think we have more elevators per person. The big thing, of course, in Madrid is the Airbnb situation. When COVID hit, an awful lot of people in the center of Madrid, they call it El Centro, which is like, that was very much taken by Airbnb people. Where I live, which is by the Retiro Park, is much more family. And a lot of people had to get out of that area. And then those places overnight became available. And people have gone in there. And then the question now is that, will government policy favor trying to get those people out so the Airbnb factor can come back in again? In terms of the yields, the issue, of course, is just what people earn, you know. Like the thing in Ireland is quite interesting. Like the president of Spain earns like 78,000, you know. Like Spain is not a rich country. Like the inequality question has to come in and then. People in Spain, even in Madrid, just they can't afford this, you know, like the idea that you could like 500,000. I mean, even in an apartment in like the most expensive barrio in Madrid, like 50,000 is just like, you know, jugador de Real Madrid kind of stuff. So yeah. It's like, this is the sort of the thing that always makes me like in Ireland, the thing that always kind of like, how can you possibly, and I, you know, so in some ways, being a smarty pants professor means, you know, you look at the numbers and the yields and how much it costs to pay and how much you pay over the lifetime of a mortgage. And you just, I don't understand how the numbers add up. So that's probably the biggest factor, which is to say the investors and how they have kind of got out of the market now and whether government policy. But the issue, of course, is that the democratic issue, which is to say that Airbnb, Spain is very fascinating. And I've said this before on the show that, you know, we had a bad bank as well, a thing called Sareb, which was actually set up by the same people as you set up NAMA. They're Alvarez and Marshall, they're a banking firm. But I used to sometimes be asked to, you know, if you want to call them vulture funds, would come in. Actually, some of these people are ex-students of mine, which go on to work for these organizations.
I'm shocked and horrified.
That's another issue. But, you know, they used to contrast how Dublin was open for business and how in Spain, you know, you'd come and you'd be brought and you'd be wined and dyed, but there was never any business done. There was a sort of an attitude in Spain that, you know, we don't screw over our own people.
And that actually happened. Politically, that happened. There is so much evidence, particularly Madrid and Barcelona, of the vultures, and I'm comfortable using that term, coming in, talking, looking at loan books, and then eventually the deal's not being done. I do want to go back to Orla, if that's okay. Orla, there is one, I don't know if you saw the question from Alejandro asking, is neighbours, a small builder, contractor, small plot, allocation of public land to enhance competition in projects like the Oscar Trainer. He argued that large developers have tried to maintain control by buying off the small contractors, and that the scramble will be for places like Limerick to be developed by foreign direct investment. This sort of reminds me of your point around the small, the many small contractors as opposed to one giant build. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
People have asked me, like, for those who don't know, Oscar Trainer is a large site on the north of Dublin that's in public ownership, and it's been controversial about how it will be developed for housing. The original plan was to package it up for one developer, where the developer would design the scheme and the city council would buy back some for social and affordable housing, and the developer could sell the private housing. What I'm saying as an alternative model is faster and cheaper and better value, which is for the local authority to master plan it. So you take the planning risk out for anybody who's going to get involved, for the local authority to put in the roads and drainage and streetlights. The state has already said they'll fund infrastructure on these sites anyway. And while that's all happening, you break up the sites into smaller lots and you let people bid for them at fixed rates like they do in parts of the Netherlands. So somebody can pay X per square meter for land, and it lets a small developer then come in de-risked in terms of planning and access to land. You can license people to use the land rather than having to pay for it up front. And you can get loads of competition, but that's really good for reinvigorating and supporting the construction sector, because if you've got 10 small developers working on that site in parallel, they have to have better employment conditions to keep their staff. They have to build quality so that people actually want their houses. And they'll all try and build fast so that they get to market before the rest.
Oh, you mean like the free market as opposed to the free rigged market?
Well, yeah, it's a pretty good business model for anybody who's interested in promoting business, because you're getting competition and new players into the market. That's good for everyone.
Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel from where we are right now? Or are people just stuck in this cycle?
I think the problem now is it'll feel like there needs to be a massive policy correction. You know, so things have gone so far down the road that they have to come. There's a long way to come back. So instead of having things that could be nudged a bit better, it'll take some serious intervention to improve.
Can I make a prediction, Martin?
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
They're going to get back in and interfere in the market again, but they'll block it in terms of houses. They won't block it in terms of apartments. They'll block it in terms of certain geographical areas. And here's the funny thing about all of this that I'm saying. The week previously, the Taoiseach had a letter in the Irish Times saying we have to sign up to CETA. It's great. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. If we do that, we sign up to the investor dispute mechanism, the parallel courts that are tied into CETA, which then mean that if we're turning around to these managed funds and saying, you can't actually access that part of our market, you can't access this part of our market.
That's right.
They could technically then sue the Irish state for impinging on their ability to make money. So the easiest implement for this is just to tax them out and disincentivize them with tax. But I don't think they have the bottle to do it, because I think Fine Gael don't want to do it, and I think Fianna Fáil don't have the political capital to push it through. And I don't think the Greens really, you know, there's a few good Greens in there who understand good housing policy, but they're not exactly in Eamon Ryan's inner circle.
But this is not going to go off the boil. The next estate will be sold or has already been sold.
Already this week, there's been, Killian Woods, always check out Killian's stuff in the Sunday Business Post, reporting on more developments where 80% of first-time buyers pushed out by these funds. Sorry, Orla, I don't know if you have a comment on that.
I mean, I think what's not been said enough maybe is that the whole market in Dublin now is framed around a huge amount of subsidy, because it's not affordable to the vast majority of people. If you're talking about prices up around 400,000, you know, something like 10% of dual earners in Dublin could afford that, and 1% of single earners. So the entire production line, if you like, and of all of this investment by funds is hugely reliant on government subsidy. And coming out of the COVID costs that we've been in, I imagine that the amount of government subsidy available is actually quite limited now. So the model that they have isn't scalable. Right. So, you know, the earlier model I was talking about of getting lots of players in and getting competition and lower prices is very scalable. You can be doing it everywhere around the country at the same time, because it's not constrained by how much government subsidy is available. But the model we are bought into is very constrained. So if you look at the affordable housing scheme, where people might be, you know, helped with another 100,000 to get a home in Dublin, the development will only happen if the government pays for the infrastructure, or where the first time buyers grant has to, you know, all of these supports that are in the system. If money isn't available to roll out that support system at scale, the whole thing grinds to a halt, really.
And I think that's a crucial point. First of all, it's not affordable, it's subsidized. Okay, that's the reality. There's a lot of different types of subsidies that are going to be used and incentives that are going to be used. But ultimately, I think I said to Martin, we were chatting during the week, it's the equivalent of someone getting a small lotto win to go off the deposit of a house in a way. And the lucky few that will get them, that's it. And I'm not going to begrudge, but surely we'd be better off with having the prices down. I'm conscious of time, and I do want to touch on, this is my own passion. I watch Spain a lot, as people would be. If you're listening to this podcast a long time, myself and Joe fight a good bit about what's happening in terms of Catalonia and Spain. And the recent elections, Joe, were a bit of a mess.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you're probably expecting me to talk about what happened in Madrid, but what's happening in Catalonia at the moment is arguably more interesting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Oriol Junqueras, who's the leader of the ERC, who's actually in jail, although he's out on day release a lot.
I forgot to put on my yellow ribbon, but I'll go get it.
But, you know, there is, something I've often said on this podcast is, you know, I said the fun will continue until the money runs out. You know, you often sort of end up with that. And the situation in it with the drive for independence is that after the election in Catalonia, two forces who have nothing in common other than the desire for an independent Catalonia have come together. One is a notionally left wing and the other is a right wing. But what they have decided now is that because of the pandemic and because of the economic situation, that, you know, independence will just have to take a back seat, that they understand that if they resist, which had been their policy, the funds won't come from Europe, which are still centrally controlled. So, you know, in some ways, there seems to be an agreement to put independence on the back burner, which, you know, considering the process has been going on, you know, that's quite a dramatic development. But I actually think whether you want to call it maturity or however it's happened, I think that the situation could not be ignored. You know, I have obviously a lot of students from places like Colombia, you know, and Bolivia and even India, actually. I mean, I have a student from India and I was just who's calling in from India, and just to watch his face of utter desperation, which is to see that things can go bad very quickly. So I think that is a sort of a sense that the fun and games have to stop because realism has to intervene, and that the pandemic, you know, has had such an effect on people's lives that they have to work on someone, even if they don't want to work with them, to bring the funds in. Now, just to quickly go through the election in Madrid, you know, as I discussed, the phenomenon was the fact that people in poorer or lower income areas had voted for a notionally right-wing candidate. And Tony, this is the other thing that we've talked about before, which is the culture wars, which is, you know, the thing that one of the things you least like, because, you know, what they have done is use the culture wars. And in the same way that Latinos in Miami voted for Trump, despite the fact that he called them rapists and God knows what, around this idea of libertad and freedom and this kind of stuff. And, you know, I hope Spain doesn't continue in this direction. There is a sort of a saying that Madrid is not Spain, that what can work in Madrid won't necessarily work in other parts of Spain.
It is a culture war, though. They were very successful in bringing communities that were disadvantaged out in the streets and telling them, you know, between the awful things like, you know, COVID's a hoax, 5G nonsense, all of these things cut. And it was well-to-do people who were worried that the national government were going to start taxing them. And that was that's the genesis of it.
Absolutely. And you know, it's a sort of incredible thing to see. I mean, the only thing, one of the things about this is that the Vox, the right-wing force, didn't gain any strength. They just added a seat. But in general, they're sort of boxed in by this, you know, because that kind of was their line and they had hoped to continue to grow, and that hasn't happened. But, you know, the other thing is the departure of Pablo Iglesias from politics and the Podemos movement, because, you know, it's 10 years since the famous, you know, the Ignados movement, and this idea that we had to move away from, you know, left versus right and insiders versus outsiders. And, you know, he has departed from politics. I mean, we're not going to see the end of him. He's going to, you know, be a media star. There's two things I always say about Pablo. You know, one thing is that the Indignados movement was shown that, I mean, he did eventually become, you know, vice president in the government, you know, that whatever you say about the forces that worked against him, and you always hear in Spain about the dark state and stuff, he did eventually become deputy prime minister of Spain. So if you get the votes, you know, ultimately, you Spain does have democratic institutions that will support you. But I think go ahead, Martin.
I'm going to push in there, Joe, because, and it's really because we're so tight on time now at the moment. But we have seen what you've talked about pretty much here in Ireland this week on a small scale.
What we've seen actually is more in the UK, whereby, you know, last week we had Don Foster talking about the fact that Boris Johnson is up to his eyes in scandals and he still romped home in all the elections. I suppose that's we saw also the Scottish National Party and the Green Party forming a majority now, which means that that means a referendum is possibly on the cards. And we have hopefully now midweek we'll be joined by one of the Scottish, not one of the Scottish Green Party successful candidates to talk about that as well. Sorry, Joe.
That seems to be the hope for Spain. While I mean, the PSOE, the Socialist Party, they've kind of sacrificed Madrid for national win. In other words, they are sort of hoping that this the famous thing that Tony Blair always said, who whatever you say about him, he knew how to win elections. That elections are won from the centre, and the theory, of course, is that Pedro Sanchez is trying to trap the PP to go towards the right and away from the centre, and he's prepared to sort of sacrifice Madrid.
Tony Blair was right about that. Now that you look at Keir Starmer, I'm really not sure that Tony Blair was right.
That was then the point about. I mean, if you want to get like all international relations about it, I don't think Tony Blair would have survived in a social media age, which is whenever you see him now talking about talking about everything he did and still assuming that would work. I think there were the way Tony was able to control the message was in a pre-social media age, and I don't think he would have got away with what he got away with.
I'm going to move us on because we have to move on about controlling the message, Tony. And this was an extraordinary week for Twitter accounts.
I mean, as someone, you run more sock puppet accounts than anyone I know. So I think you invented the term, didn't you?
I have to say, I don't know how you would find the time to run so many. So I just don't know. I find it hard to run one account.
There's a funny side to this, and there's a sinister side to this.
Yeah.
The sinister side to this was the bullying and harassment and the misogyny and the carry on that went on by the individual Owen Harris in question. The way it's been happening. Do we think it's endemic? Of course, I think it's endemic. I made the point that it's rife. I mean, Orla, you're a woman online who has opinions about housing. You know, how dare you? I've seen that those replies by Build Houses 127999 who reply to everything you say. You must have saw that today, this week, and thought, oh God.
But I just say something in defense of Twitter. In my experience, and I've been on Twitter a while and I'm kind of active tweeter, 95% of Twitter is actually really genuine, nice people who engage, who are respectful, who share information very openly. It's an absolute hive of COVID collaboration among researchers around the world and across disciplines, which has been amazing. I am connected to people all over the world in all sorts of disciplines who are sharing information every day. And there is a lot of that kind of networking and informal collaboration that has developed out of Twitter, and we're now communicating in other ways. There's a very small part of Twitter that is a bit toxic sometimes, and it can come in waves, so it's obviously orchestrated. So it's a bit like being in a pub. Most of what's going on is great crack, and occasionally there a row will break out and somebody has to be taken out. But I think a lot of the criticism of social media maybe is unfair, but there is a nasty underhand element sometimes, and people have to. But the vast majority of it, in my experience, is not that.
And I think you're right to say that a lot of the criticism is unfair, because a lot of the criticism comes from mainstream media who's running the horrible accounts. It is the next time I see something in a newspaper that says something about social media is toxic, go away, just go away.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also holds people to account in real time, and some people are very uncomfortable with that.
Yeah,
when you
hear stupid sentences like, ban all anonymous accounts, ban this, ban that, regulate this, and you think, you can't have these people who just don't understand the mechanism, and they don't. And Orla, key point there, it's accountability in real time, and it's social memory as well. It's very good at actual, when you have someone who said something and they've made a statement 3 months earlier that contradicts that. It has that way of bringing it back. So it does something. We're really, really going to have to wrap, because we want to get some questions in at the end. A couple of things just this week. Watch what the EU is going to do around the TRIPS waiver, folks, because Biden has put pressure on now saying, let's lift the IP, let's get people producing these India stands ready. And Macron, Joe, you probably know, they were coming out saying, no, let's not do it that way. The EU is not agreeing. It's not a good look for us in Europe at the moment. And we'll be going back to Palestine this week because there are some really troubling developments recently. And our friend Hannah Salah in Gaza is also going to.
I think, Tony, just on that, I mean, the big thing that I saw is how Ireland's sort of FDI thing has caught up on us. You know, we're not going to get very much money from pandemic relief because our GDP figures are so inflated. You know, Spain is going to get a lot of money, and Spain has literally spent an awful lot of time putting in very good and detailed proposals. You know, Spain is famously last minute, but when something happens, people have come together. So, I mean, obviously the country has been very much affected by this because of tourism and stuff. But, you know, it's funny how we think we were so clever about inflating our GDP and stuff like that. But, you know, this is not a victimless crime, and, you know, we're not going to get much money because of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's a, you know, the abuse I get on Twitter is mainly from people who are defending the FDI model, because I defend indigenous industries. You know, we see even Sudocream is leaving Ireland. You know, you want to talk about, you know, your Oscar trainers and your stuff. Sudocream should be the thing that should, you know, put us all on.
It's because they've got rid of all the irritating arseholes, Joe.
Yeah, there's a much bigger COVID story that can help India and other countries this week that's not getting attention. A bigger story than the TRIPS waiver, which is about the vaccines. The World Health Organization has changed its position on how the virus is transmitted, and the Center for Disease Control in America has changed its position. And this has massive implications for Ireland's response to the pandemic, because they're both basically saying now that this is an airborne virus. It's mostly inhaled. Washing our hands is not the way to stop it. And that it's mostly an issue with buildings, indoor environments, and masks. And that is a very different strategy to what we've been doing so far. And in some ways, it goes back to the beginning of this with Lorraine talking about people in overcrowded housing and people in hubs and direct provision and in hotel accommodation. That's where we have to put the pandemic effort now, is to protect people in those indoor environments where they're at high risk, in overcrowding and in meat factories and other places. So that's a bigger story. And if that message can get across clearly to India and Nepal and other countries that are in a really bad state, that public health message can have an impact this week. A vaccine program is not going to have an impact for months. So I think we need to here amplify that message for developing countries as well.
I think that's. I think we'll wrap there. I do want to say to Mick Finnegan, who's there. Well done, Mick. You got sorted out in Trinity this week. Congratulations. Where everybody's delighted for you. And stop stealing my quotes for your Sunday morning walks, please. If you want to come to the Tortoise Shack weekly specials, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and you get to have your say. And we will do that now. We will turn over the mics. There are loads of comments. So if anybody wants to, you can throw your hands up and let us know if you want to add any points. Thanks very much.